Hello there, Namilla Benson with you on this very special and deeply personal edition of The Art Show. Today we explore the role of creativity for Australia's closest neighbour as I take you to my homeland, Papua New Guinea, where this week marks 45 years of independence.
Papua New Guinea is independent and free, as the Governor-General Sir John Guise proclaims on radio.
Papua New Guinea is now independent. The constitution of the independent state of Papua New Guinea, under which all power rests with the people, is now in effect. We have at this point in time broken with our colonial past, and we now stand as an independent nation in our own right.
From the ABC archives, a historic moment from 1975 for Papua New Guinea, marking the nation's official independence and the end of nearly seven decades of Australian rule. Speaking there, the late politician Sir John Guise, Papua New Guinea's first Governor-General, officially pronouncing the country's independence on the 16th of September in 1975. On this episode, we're exploring this uniquely diverse Melanesian nation, which is home to over 800 languages. So what role has art played in PNG's development and its engagement with Australia since independence? My first guest today is Dr. Michael Mell. Michael is a performance artist, writer, curator, and he's also manager of Pacific and International Collections at Australian Museum. Avinon, Michael, thanks for joining us on The Art Show.
Avinon lo yubla. Avinon lo yunamila. I'm a Maslow Stapwan Damu. Happy to be with you.
So this week's episode marks 45 years of PNG independence, and I want to start off with your life pre-independence in PNG. Where did you grow up?
Oh, man, you're telling me to go back or come forward, please. No, it's all good. It's all good. I grew up in Hagen, up in the highlands of Papua New Guinea. And that's where I spent my childhood and grew up there. And pretty much, yeah, that's where home is. All the same, a Papua New Guinean at large, yeah.
So where were you when PNG gained independence? Because I'm wondering how you marked the occasion.
Oh, listen, I went to a Catholic high school, and it was Fatima High School. That's about 40 km out of Hagen. And at that time, it was run by the Christian Brothers. And it was a very good experience. And in fact, around 70, 72, 73 was when I went there to start. I started what was then Form 1. And of course, 75 was our Form 3. And Form 3 would be grade 9 these days. And so I, at that time, was part of what the Christian Brothers had established, a school band. And during that year, in 75, I was, beating the bass drum. And so having that and then uniformed and everything. And I remember distinctly marching, leading all the schools with the school band up through Hagen Town. Yeah, and it was a very, very special occasion where hundreds and hundreds, I mean thousands of people had come to town and all decorated, all just to mark, of course, this significant occasion. And there was such a throng of people and a lot of activity, but I distinctly remember marching through and leading the schools that had come with the school band from Fatima High School then. And it was a great occasion, and I still remember it, yeah. Yeah.
It's so interesting, Michael, that you talk about your school days, and because you've said that one of the consequences of going to school and being educated is that in many ways, as a kid, you're forced to learn new ways whilst being forced to unlearn some of your cultural ways, particularly when it comes to language. And you've spoken about this moment where you realised that you were very fluent in English but quite disconnected from your own language. What was the moment where you started to reconnect again to your language?
It was really quite late in the piece, actually. In terms of education, I went through obviously high school and then on to teacher training. And it was later when I was beginning to do my doctoral studies is when I really re-examined myself, as it were. I really, I was reading people like Paulo Freire, and at that time, and much earlier in the 60s and 70s, he used theater in a way to raise a consciousness of the world as was, as is, and how you'd want it to be. And there was a particular way in which he describes in terms of raising or becoming more conscious, where the world as you see it is not given. It's actually constructed. It's actually determined and determined by people. You can actually shape it yourself if you want to, but you must be aware of the fact that as things are, it's not a given, it's constructed. So to make English, to make this system of knowledge a centerpiece and my own sense of my childhood as peripheral, as outside of, it didn't seem right. Now I began to see that there were certainly some challenges. The challenges being our art was made to be, basically it was sinful to continue and carry on. We had to cover our bodies, we had to dress up in this particular way, and so we had to discard, throw away the shields, throw away the spears, throw away, discard everything, because we are now going to be in this way. So that was pretty much the church. The government also, at that time, of course, asked us to throw away from tools then to clothes. So many of those things that were introduced to us suddenly overtook, and we disbanded with our own. And then, of course, something else that I realized quite seriously was happening. We began to take on new language. So in this case, pidgin. I could not speak pidgin as a kid when I was growing up. Gradually, I began to learn it. English was the first language that I started to learn in school, in prep. So there was at no time bridging between my vernacular to English. If I spoke vernacular, we were forbidden to speak that at school. We were to speak that at home. And so more and more of my time in school was filled up with English, and later on, pidgin. So inevitably, you learn more of your own, your introduced languages. You take more of the clothes. You take more of their food. In fact, your behavior begins to change. And I could see that my language was now further away. And in fact, I became a little bit tongue-tied. I could see that I could not speak my language properly. I had to code switch. In other words, I would speak my language or speak my language, and when I, in my mind, I ran short of it, I put an English word into it. So more of my language is now being replaced by English words or pidgin. So my language was being forgotten. So I had to then, at my time for that, doing this PhD, relearn my language. And every time I did my went back to my community, I made a point of not speaking English or pidgin. Every time I interacted with my community, it was only in vernacular, my language. And it was a conscious effort. It was an effort to bring back and bring it to the present, this language. So when I wanted to speak in language and to my community, I could code switch like a dial on the radio station. I could go to Radio Hagen and to the Moge, and I say, "Enim kandaye, kavga moromani. How are you? Are you all right?" So that kind of transition, and then I could come back into this dial, speaking in English, or to someone else, it might be, "You stop all right." So that ability to code switch in my own mind is really an empowering process. It's our capacity to be able to hold all of that knowledge and information and then have a choice of when to use it and to whom we would like to use it with. There are so many things embedded in our languages. Language alone is not good alone, of course. It needs to be reflected in the things we do, in the things we celebrate and sing and dance and engage in. It needs to have substance. It needs to reflect the world around us. Language alone as mere words is not good enough. So therefore, PNG for me is very significant that we realize this balance and this precariousness, if you like, that we carry. So it's been a tough journey for me, but a very important one, a very significant one for myself as a person.
Yeah, that capacity to code switch is just so important in all aspects of our lives. And I want to get you to talk about how you bring that ability to code switch to your arts practice. How would you describe your arts practice?
Yes. When I talk about the arts practice in the Moge, or at least up in the Highlands in Hagen, when you perform and when you engage with a performance process, everything is, of course, pretty much on you. The body decoration, everything that's to do with the feathers, and all of these things are connected. And, of course, when you perform, you just don't just simply perform. And there are reasons why you perform. There's a basis for that. So it may have been a mortuary ceremony. And at the end of the ceremony, you now need to appease everyone that's in mourning and set them free, set them off to go back to their world. In other words, to where they are. And you need to get on with life. So you need to organize things. Or if there had been a fight, or if there had been some event where you now need to make peace. And that peacemaking process is now the reason why you need to obviously dress up. So art making is not just simply on the basis of I need to make art. I need to decorate my body. There are reasons and connections to other things that are very much a part of our community. So when I look at Western art, there is a way in which we make art as a separate thing. In other words, you could hang it on the wall and have a look at it, admire it for what it is, and engage with it in the way it treats your mind or your spirit, whatever you want to call, and then leave it at that. Whereas in our case, our arts are very much connected to people and relationships between our past and our present in order to navigate the future.
And performance really does form such a unique part of the experience whereby you encourage the audience to engage. Can you talk us through? There was one work that I saw you perform at Quagoma from a few years ago where you encourage the audience to construct their own native. I use those words in inverted commas. What did you want to address in that work? Because I imagine there would have been a lot of discomfort on the one hand, but then people did get involved and they did, so to speak, construct their own native.
Yes. The name of that performance piece was called Place Namel. That's in pidgin for a good translation might be our space or our place. And it was a performance piece that I collaborated with my late wife in as part of what was then the Queensland Art Gallery, today Kagoma, of course, in 1996, we were asked to present a piece. And in that piece, we basically developed a plasingsing. In other words, in the Hagen communities, you always have a community space where you come to talk, where you come to have community gatherings and celebrate things, or whatever the occasion is. The center space is a very important part of our communities. And so within that space and around that space, we had the audience members gathered, and in the middle, we had a frame. It was a rectangular frame stuck by metal pieces at the bottom. My late wife was then behind that frame to be decorated. We brought feathers, and all the body decoration that would be put on her left on the inside. And then the audience members who were sitting in the center space or place namel would then be brought in through the rectangle to go through the frame to decorate my late wife. And then she would eventually emerge through the frame and perform. The process of engaging was quite challenging for some members of the audience. And for some, it was quite a novelty, if you like. Yes.
So what were some of the things that you would shout at the audience to prompt them to get involved?
I basically said, come, here is your native. Come through the frame and touch and decorate and then get the native to come and perform. And so it's that process. And of course, that's based on the basis that in Hagen, and with the Moge and many of the other communities, when you were performing, you did not have all the bilas yourself. You had to gather them from members of the community, and they would come. So you'd have in-laws come in, or your aunties her children, or her relationships in terms of her marriage, they would come to contribute towards your performance. So it wasn't a unilateral process. It was collaborative. So that strategy was not necessarily created for that event. It was building on the strategies of my own community's performance process.
Yeah. So how did people respond?
There were people who had fun, who really wanted to go in and really connect with and touch and put feathers and put oil on the body and paint the face. And there were others that were very, very tentative, others who refused to stand up and come out. No one had to be forced, but yeah, that was the experience, yeah.
That's so interesting to me, because approaches to Melanesian art have tended to be from a distance and quite anthropological, almost as if we're a static and not contemporary culture. What is the Australian art world like when it comes to contemporary Papua New Guinean art?
I think in many ways, the legacies of Western art continue to dog us in the way that our cultures are framed. In museums, for example, in the conventional sense of museums where a lot of our history has been kept. But of course, it's not necessarily our history. Quite a lot of that history has been their history through which we have been framed and constructed. So our ability now to look at that history, not to debunk that history, but really begin to work with and offer alongside it an alternative. And the alternatives, of course, the indigenous ways of looking at and engaging with, making and, you know, valuing art, if you like. So in this context today, there is room now for us to begin to open up and say, if this is the way we framed you, what are some of the other options and what are some of the other ways? Because you framing us means that you always are referencing us through your looking glass, through your frame. And it's really rearranging the furniture to be more inclusive, more about options and alternates where you now need to see other ways rather than the way. And I think that's one of the challenges in working, in living in cultural institutions. And in fact, looking at the Pacific and looking at Pacific art, PNG art, the danger is you are framed in that way all the time. And that in itself is a danger, because we are often boxed in without really looking at the details. And that can not only happen in art, but in many, many other aspects, whether it be economic, social, political, in many other ways, where you have the there is a lack. I represent the filling up of the gap. I think better that we go in and understand the apparent gaps and see where the challenges are, rather than assuming that you have the answers and you are Mr. Fix-It or Miss Fix-It. And I think some of those relationships, they need to really be carefully untangled. Yeah.
So how do you understand the relationship between PNG and Australia today?
In Australia, there has been a since independence, if you like. And Australia's connection with PNG is, of course, very deep-seated. And that deep-seatedness reconnects, of course, to the cultural side of things, the political side of things, the historical in terms of the war history. Mm. And I must say, for the Pacific, whether it's the Coral Sea, whether it's Guadalcanal, whether it's Kokoda Track, whether it's Rabaul, whether it's Wewak, or whether it's Buna, or whether it's Milne Bay, Alatau, those are places where Australia, of course, intervened in the war. And in many ways, and I say this with the greatest of respect to all that have given their lives. Of course, having the Pacific in the context of Australia finding its own sense of a nation, that's very significant. But in many other respects, the Pacific quite often is the child that's misbehaving, the child that always is belligerent, can't do anything, or if can, it makes a mess of it all the time. So there is a relationship that's very significant to how this part of the world here in Australia and how the Pacific, and in this case, PNG, how we see ourselves and that relationship. So taking that broad perspective into the cultural landscape, a lot of the relationships between PNG and Australia as in the cultural landscape has happened, but not in the way that I think it could really be strengthened. Mm-hmm. A lot of the collections that are in and across Australia in many of the respectable museums are from PNG. And of course, the stories of how they got here go as far back into the 19th, maybe 18th century. And the stories are there in relation to the communities that the people went to, and the artifacts or pieces that were brought back lie in the hallways or the shelves of museums. And I think it needs to be shared between art that is about us, art that's got an Australian side of the story to it, and also a PNG side of the story to it. Let's see the shared histories rather than showing New Guinea art in the distance. I think there's got to be a lot more than that. And the arts quite often can provide that platform, because the collections are your history as much as ours. Just like the war that the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels fought with you was our war. And it's as much part of your mythologizing of being a nation as much as it's PNG's mythologizing of Australians and Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels. It was our war to the making of great nations. Because when you look at PNG, we are a land of 1,000 tribes.
Yeah.
And if there's a need for any kind of mythologizing of a common ancestry, maybe those platforms would be useful too. And it now needs to drive. And so when you talk about a lot of the multitude of cultures, but at the same time, some of the things that makes us as a nation, I think some of those things need to be there. But aside from the war, in terms of the cultural landscape, there needs to be more engagement and interactions. And that's the, having said that, there are a number of institutions that have made impact, continue to make impact. Kagoma, for example, they have every triennial, you know, they do a great thing about this. And in the current Sydney Biennale, I mean, there's a Papua New Guinean artist who's involved in there too.
Eric Bridgman, that's right.
And so forth. So they are beginning to make some changes and inclusions, not inclusions by necessity, but by the fact that they are making something about themselves and about being Papua New Guinean and / Australian. And I think those kinds of things provide more of that interactivity. And I think that space needs more in terms of the cultural space and the interactivity and the relationships between Australia and Papua New Guinea.
Yeah. So how do you've spoken really well, just very broadly about that relationship and those shared histories between Australia and Papua New Guinea. So in a nutshell, what do you see is the role of PNG art in international development and regional engagement?
Very, very significant. Very significant. And you could talk about this the whole length. I mean, in fact, if anything, but for the opportunity and for this time, in terms of development, how do we see development? I think development, we need to unpack it. Unpack it in the way that how does development come through to places like New Guinea where there are so many challenges and so many cultures and a lot of history? So when we talk about development, we need to unpack it very, very carefully. And for example, when you're now talking about development, development for me includes language development, the promotion of your own languages as much as you promote English. Development is a fairly loaded one, and the way it's being thrown into and brought about is danger. So for me, I think we need to be very careful. And in PNG now, there's really a need for that unpacking. Unfortunately, some of our processes and decision making in PNG hasn't been that way. We take full on everything that's coming because we quite often are seen ourselves. And that's, of course, the neocolonialism, where we agree with you that bring it on. When in fact, we're really, hang on a minute, let me check. That quite often needs to happen more and more in house, in country, in PNG, for example. But those are some challenges for us, I think, in this day and age, after 45 years of independence, and a lot of things have happened. I think there's a lot more that needs to be unpacked and repacked to really get a sense of our communities and our people and our relationships with anyone outside of what is PNG today. Yeah,
it's true. We carry it deep within.
Absolutely.
You mentioned Eric Bridgman before, who's a former guest on this program. Also, Lisa Hilly, a Tolai artist that we featured on the show before.
Correct.
Who are contemporary PNG artists that are exciting you right now that you think Australian museums need to get on their radar?
I think in many ways, when you look at the two that you've just mentioned in relation to the work they're doing, one of some of the exciting parts of it is with Lisa, in the more recent work that she's been able to do, or over the last 4 or 5 years, she's really worked with her own culture, her own community in relation to the Tolai. And then, of course, working with aspects of her community in relation to the Midi, or this particular garment or particular jewelry, if you like, that's worn by the men, or was worn then, and how it was made and put together, for Lisa to have that revelation in the Australian Museum back then, and then now to begin for it to have become a part of her work and her connectivity, I think that's very exciting. The excitement is largely based on the fact that you bring the past to the present. You bring the past not only in terms of the object itself, but the knowledge that's imbued with it, the stories that connect with it, and I think that's very important. And for Eric Bridgman also, I think the ability not only to deal with the Highland shields in the way that he's constructed them and brought them, the fact that he's decided that he would work the shields with members of his community in Kujip up in the in Jawaka.
Yes.
Getting those youth and young people to work with him and depict imagery and work with the shields. Of course, the shields were very much very important aspects to communities up there. Quite often when you think of shields, they quite often represent war. But of course, shields in many ways were also part of singing and celebration. I quite often, just digress a little bit on this one, quite often think of shields like our skin. Shields are a covering, a protective device. You only need now to lay the shield down to reveal the beauty that lies within. And in many ways, for Eric to begin to use that shield to talk about the finery and the feathers and the singing and the dancing that he's brought on, in the way that, and also that the fact that you can contribute towards an art process by involving community rather than yourself, that the opportunity to engage with Australians and the Australian public through art is not a solitary work, because artist in PNG context is a community affair. Those kinds of processes now being displayed and shared in this world today are really exciting. And I think for PNG in these artists, contemporary artists, but very much aware of their history and their heritage, and bringing that history and heritage to the present is a challenge that's for many Papua New Guineans and for many of us, to saying, "Mi save, I know. Plesbla mi stap long way. Oh, plesbla, my place is far away." But we don't need to be forlorn. We don't need to be lonely. It only needs to say that we can, you are someone, you stop all right. It's that ability to bring that the past into the present. It's that ability to do these things and to live with them, rather than always casting a long eye into the landscape before the sun sets. Let me look at culture.
I guess my final question to you, Michael, I've so enjoyed speaking with you. 45 years on, we celebrate and mark another year of PNG independence. What is the one thing you feel proudest of about Papua New Guinea that you want Australians to know?
I think, you know, Papua New Guineans, and we are 45. Because of COVID, we may not be able to celebrate it as in numbers as we might. But that said, the fact that we still are a country, there are issues and challenges as there are here as anywhere else. And the fact that we are a country, we have had our share of challenges and difficulties, but we've also had some wonderful things that have happened to us. And we're still intact as a country. And that, I think, for me, makes me the proud. In fact, I finished my time with the Australian Museum towards the end of this year. And rather than stay here or continue in some way format, I'm more than happy to go home. Why do I want to go home? Basically because I feel very strongly connected to community. And if I want to advocate for and articulate that, I'd rather be there, because it's very easy to speak of from a distance. In the safety, supposed safety, I say this with that reason, because it's always easy to look at the distance and imagine what possibilities there might be. But it's better to be in there, rub shoulders with the real sense of where things are, and then look out and say, I've got an option, I've got opportunity. So that's why I want to go back rather than be here and talk about it. And then if I can inform Australians, but what it is about PNG and what's exciting, I think it's better being on the inside rather than being on the outside looking in. So I look forward to going back. And that gives you an indication that I believe in that place and I believe in the people. We've had our share of our difficulties, but after 45 years, we're all on a learning curve. And who would have talked about COVID-19? And COVID-19 certainly has indicated the weak links in a system that we have in this country, in Australia or anywhere else. When I go back, first of all, I'm going to go back to what's happening in your home country or in your homeland, in Rabaul. For example, people are now talking to buying things and exchanging goods using shell money. Because money is no longer available as easily and as readily. Because COVID is now making it such that their jobs are no longer there. People are no longer able to earn the income. But the land is there. So people are being encouraged to toil the land. And then if you want to buy, you don't have to use the Western money. You can use other money, your own system of exchange and so forth. Now, that's the exciting part of these things, that our history and our heritage need not be in museums, man. We need to bring it out and say, live it, celebrate it, engage with it, and then say, this is the alternate. And the alternate is good. And I think then, 45 years, another 45, bring it on, baby, based on our own.
Michael, I am so rapt that I've had a chance to speak with you, truly. So thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Dr. Michael Mell, performance artist, academic, curator, and manager of Pacific and International Collections at Australian Museum. You can head to our webpage to find a link to his work. We're marking 45 years of independence for Papua New Guinea on this episode of The Art Show. Let's head into one of PNG's most successful music artists, Ngairi. This is her song, Shiva.
Oh, I never thought you'd come to see me, 'cause I'm blinded by the noise and the mess of the city trying to kill me.
The world of visual art is a space that constantly provokes and pokes my brain. And I love that every now and then someone carves out their own space in the arts game to create their own path. Wendy Moke is one such creative. She's a Papua New Guinean actor, writer, and visual artist based in Australia. And her powerful new exhibition, The Merry Project, focuses on stories of cultural identity and Black womanhood in PNG. The Merry Project is supposed to be on right now at the North Site Gallery in Cairns, but during these COVID times, the exhibition can't happen in that space, but part of it has gone digital. Wendy Moke, Avinon, and hello.
Sister, how are you?
Going so well and very excited to be talking about the Merry Project. Now, before we get started proper, I should probably get you to explain for listeners what the word Merry means in PNG. And it feels kind of strange not to say it with the rolling of the R.
Right? Yeah. And it's, you know, and Tokwisin 101, the word Meri. Meri means woman, girl, or wife. It's derived from the word Mary. And so, yeah, so the proper pronunciation would be to roll your R's and Meri.
And of course, in an Australian context, we tend to kind of anglicise and soften the R, don't we?
Yes, we don't hit the R at its full capacity, the way it needs to be performed, but yes.
So when we're talking about the Merry Project, explain for us what sparked it.
So the Merry Project, I think ultimately, was a culmination of years of trying to unpack what it means to be a PNG woman, both on home soil and also away from that as well. You know, it came from a lot of conversations that myself and other PNG women, you know, sitting around having cups of tea and discussing about, you know, all our triumphs and the trials of being PNG women and what it means and how we carry ourselves in a modern day context. So I guess that was the seedling from which this project grew from, was gaining more of a bigger understanding of the way we define ourselves.
Who are the women that you've handpicked to be involved in this project? Because I guess I really want to know, what was it about the stories of the women who feature in the Mary Project that compelled you to include them?
Yeah, absolutely. So the exhibition that that is currently being scheduled for November next year at Northside Contemporary Gallery in Cairns, that exhibition features women in Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea, and in Cairns. And those women were selected because I wanted to really sort of encapsulate a very diverse group of women. And I think we sort of view PNG women based upon what this idea of success is. So I think a lot of people are expecting women, you know, that hold professions such as lawyers and doctors, because to a lot of us, that's what success is and that's what should be celebrated. Whereas my focus was, yes, all those women are important as well, but I'm also interested in women that are market mamas, you know, the women that are out selling produce or making bilams, and women that exist in boardrooms, that are lawyers, that are engineers, but they're also stay-at-home moms. So I wanted it to really encompass a wide range of women, just to really highlight that we exist in more ways than one, and that all those levels need to be celebrated.
But this is what I love. I mean, there's so much to unpack in terms of discourse and debates. And doing an exhibition like the Mary Project, what format will it take? How are you holding these conversations, Wendy? Because I'm wondering, what are the creative ways you're making space for women to share their stories?
Initially, I thought it'd be a series of portraits capturing PNG women in contemporary landscapes. I wanted to re-envision the way people see PNG women. Oftentimes, you'll see PNG women on a beach with the hibiscus in their hair, you know, these pretty wahinas, that type of narrative.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to smash that. You know, I wanted PNG women to be in these, like, you know, whether it's like a very urban, gritty, contemporary settings. You know, I just wanted to flip it and break that all. And so that's how it started. And the more that I engaged with each of the women that I approach, it kind of dawned on me that a photograph is not merely enough. Because what happens is people see that photograph and they still take away from it what they believe that is, or who she is. So what I started to do was actually sit down and have conversations with these women. And I recorded our conversations with their consent and talked about and asked them specific questions about their journey as PNG women. And so a lot of that audio is actually will also be shown at the exhibition. Will be played at the exhibition with the portraits as well. So it'll be a visual and audio sort of landscape. The idea being that we need to see and also hear her.
And you've got a virtual storytelling series that's now on YouTube. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Silence is not our way. It is not our nature. Our laugh pushes and pulls the waves that beat the shore. Our cries pull waves down our cheeks, and our songs push them away. My Sina and my Bubu teach me without words. My ancestors teach me without words. Our women are our hearts. Our women are our strength.
A young woman identified only as Hallie, who has taken part in the Mary Project, a project that uses vision and sound to examine cultural identity and gender from PNG women's perspectives. On Radio National, this is The Art Show. I'm Namila Benson and I'm speaking with Wendy Mocke, the artist behind the Mary Project. Wendy, why is it important for you to use your work to create platforms where people can take ownership of their own stories? Because I actually first came across your work via the collective called Melanin House.
Yes. You know, and Melanin House was actually a collective that myself and a group of friends started. And it was thought up whilst I was training at the National Institute of Dramatic Art. And it was developed as a need to create safe spaces for Black artists and artists of color, because oftentimes we are in these environments and in these spaces that aren't the most safest for us to navigate, and the implications that it has not only on us as people, but as on our work is particularly damaging. This collective aims to create an environment and opportunities to be able to really nurture and foster talent in our own communities in a way that is healthy, in a way that celebrates them and supports them in their abilities. So that was something that my friends and I sort of like whipped up a couple of years ago. Mm. And it's definitely been exciting.
As a PNG artist and creative, how responsive is the Australian arts world, whether it's theatres or museums, to your work as a Melanesian artist?
I would say it's definitely been, you know, a mixture of different responses. And I feel that, you know, Australia has a perceived notion of what the art, Pacifica art is. And a lot of that is very colonial in its approach. And so a lot of the times they see us as these people that from a colonial sort of landscape and idea of what we are, as opposed to what we actually are in real life. And so I think my passion as an artist and what really drives me is about breaking and smashing all those narratives, because it's, in a way, it's reclaiming our identity. You know, I feel that colonization really disrupted our culture and the way that our people lived and impacted our lives so greatly that we're still dealing with a lot of these things. And so for me as an artist, it's a way of reclaiming some of that was lost, and being able to also talk about how fluid our culture is. And it's constantly evolving and adapting, but it's very much in who we are as people. And so I love sort of flipping stuff on its head and breaking all those notions.
But it requires a lot of work as well, because you don't have the luxury to just be an artist. And in fact, your activism has to come into play as well, because, tell us about the work that you as an artist have had to do that is very much tied in with the broader Black Lives Matter conversation, because I think so many of us are kind of dealing with those issues at the moment, with taking on our workplaces and taking on our industries.
Oh, sister, how much time do you have? I mean, you know, there are days that I just wish that I could just pick up a text, learn my lines, get on stage or on set and just act or just write. And I think our activism is so much a part of who we are. And unfortunately, we are a representation of our community without any choice a lot of the times. So, you know, a lot of that is put on us, and therefore we have to carry a lot of the weight of having to, you know, call stuff out, you know, and hold people accountable. So, you know, a lot of the times I do find myself in these positions where I, you know, if I'm working on a show, I will, you know, have to bring up the, you know, certain things that may not be right in the way certain characters are portrayed, if it's tokenistic, if it's stereotypical, you know, and those are all the things that I've never not have done. It's unfortunately so much a part of, and I'm hoping that the industry will change and it will learn and grow, and it'll be able to give, you know, performers the chance, particularly, you know, Black POC performers, you know, First Nation, the ability just to be ourselves without always having to talk about our trauma or bring that to those spaces all the time. Sometimes we just want to be able to just be ourselves.
My final question that I'm going to ask you is, how has being involved with other PNG women on the Merry Project helped further instill your sense of PNG and Black womanhood?
It has been one of the most humbling, inspiring, enraging but also satisfying things that I've done as an artist. Because in a way, when I say that it's like coming home, it really is like coming home. Because for years, particularly, you know, for PNG women, we're always defined by other people and the actions by other people. And being able to take space without permission, without having to apologize, and being honest and being vulnerable and being okay with that, it's really instilled in me in a sense that, like, you know, PNG women, we're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Because we're fantastic. We are really, really fantastic. And we deserve all the accolades that we, not only that people give us, but that we give ourselves. Because I believe that a lot of times we don't give ourselves enough credit because we're so busy fighting for other people. And I believe that the Mary Project is that opportunity to celebrate us in all our glory.
Wendy, I love watching your star continue to rise, and I love watching what you're doing for Pacific Women's Stories. Thank you so much for joining us on The Art Show.
Thank you so much for your time. And also, thank you for pronouncing my name, my surname properly, literally when you opened up the show and pronounced my name how it's supposed to be pronounced. I literally was like, I'm going to cry. So thank you for even just that. And that's, you know, thank you so much for having me. And it's been an absolute privilege. Thank you, number one.
I know that I'm up against an army of one talks if I don't get the pronunciation right. Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you.
That's Wendy Moke, proud PNG actor, writer, and visual artist based in Australia. And you can link to Wendy's wonderful work via our website. And that's it for the show. My thanks to producer Anna Frey Taylor, also Claire Kremen from ABC Archives, and RN's wonderful team of sound engineers who help us make the show each week. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to the Art Show podcast so you will never miss an episode. And whilst you're there, leave us a review. You know, like 5 stars. Hint, hint. I'm Namila Benson. I'll catch you next time, and I'm going to leave you with a man who hails from my hometown, Rabaul. This is Uncle George Telek with his song White Palagaras. And I'm going to bid you farewell in my traditional Kwanawa language from Rabaul by saying Yoro. I'll see you later.